Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
I think that anytime a group of people form a family, either on purpose or just by birth, there's no way that that kind of combustible combination of these different personalities, it's going to create weirdness.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. When author Kevin Wilson talks about combustibles, he means exactly what he says. His new novel, Nothing to See Here, features a set of twins who, when they get agitated, literally catch on fire. But the book is about way more than that. It's about how families work, and what it means to love, and how to find a place that you can call home. In other words, Kevin Wilson writes about the needs and desires that smolder in the background of all our lives. Here's our conversation. I guess I have to ask about the most obvious thing, which is that this book you've written has as sort of a centerpiece, spontaneous combustion. And my understanding is that that's not the first time that's appeared in your work.
Yeah, no, that's correct. It's my obsession, right? It's the thing I come to again and again. So in my first book of stories, I had a boy whose parents died by spontaneously combusting, and I thought, I've got that out of my system. And then I wrote a novel where there was a woman, she had an acting job where she took care of children who burst into flames. And I could just feel that I wasn't ready to let go of it. I think, you know, a lot of my obsessions are more normal, maybe, but I keep coming back to that idea. And so I knew for this book, I was going to go back into it.
And where did that come from, you think?
It's from childhood, like pretty much everything that are my obsessions. It's from when I was a kid, and the Time Life series, Mysteries of the Unknown. It was like this handsome compendium of like encyclopedias that you could buy.
You sort of mentioned that in passing in the book at one point, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so I was obsessed with them. My friend had them, and you know, this was before the internet, so that really was my internet, to find these kind of weird pockets of information. And there was a small little thing on spontaneous human combustion. And you know, even as a child, I was like, I don't truly believe that this is real. But I wanted it to be real, right? I wanted there to be some sort of magic in the world. And that seemed like a great opportunity. And so I've just held on to it. And I think in my head, when I was a kid, I was a little worried I might burst into flames, right? It became a kind of concern. And then as I got older, you know, in the real world touches up against you more as you get older, I wanted to be able to burst in the flames, because then people would leave me alone. Like if I'm in a meeting that's not going well, if I could just burst into flames, then I could leave. You know,
no,
I'd have a visible
meeting, yes.
I'd have a visible excuse rather than just saying I'm super anxious, right? So I wanted it. And so I think that's why I return to it in my work, because it is this fascination that I can't let go of.
And certainly I think when you're a little kid, especially, this idea that you have this whatever it is, rage or something inside you, that when you're a kid, you really don't feel like you can control it.
Yeah.
You know, and then there's something about that, like, what's going to happen to me in this next few moments or whatever, that does feel like, you know, you're right on the edge of something that you don't understand and are worried about, you know. And
exactly.
And that's kind of how you felt as a kid?
Yeah, it was this internal anxiety, and it felt very plausible that I could burst into flames, because there was this agitation inside of me and in my brain and in my body. And so that was the scary part. But then, you know, like as a child, I loved comic books, and there's the Human Torch. And
sure.
And he is unaffected by the flame, right? Like his beautiful blonde hair is not singed. And so I love this idea that you could have this fire, you could hold it inside of you, and it can manifest itself when you wanted, but it wouldn't actually hurt you. And so that initial fear became like, oh, it could be a superpower. And I love that.
Yeah. And I've heard that and read that you had Tourette's, or I guess still do.
Yeah.
And growing up especially, it manifested itself in sort of visions in your head. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So I wasn't diagnosed with Tourette's until I was an adult.
Okay.
And even now, some people are like, I don't think that's what it is. I think it might be something else. But that's what my neurologist and my doctors told me. And I accepted it because I wanted to get better, right? I wanted some sort of treatment. But as a kid, yeah, these things were these tics and these recurring bad thoughts, just kind of awful thoughts that would kind of cycle through my brain. And then as a way to kind of stop thinking about them, I would have these tics, like little shakes of my head, make little sounds. So yeah, I mean, those, and one of those recurring images is someone bursting into flames, you know, and as disturbing as it was, those images, when they flash to me, and they usually are kind of concerning, there's something seductive about them that I have to shake my head so I don't linger too long on what it would be like to burst into flames.
Right. So you shake your head as a way to get rid of it, but
yeah.
But it's also, you may not want to.
Right. There's a moment where if you linger too long, you fall into that hole, right? So I try to snap myself out of it.
And obviously what it sounds like you're experiencing, I think, is different than what most people understand as Tourette's, which is somebody spouting out bad words or that sort of thing. And so how did your parents deal with that when you were younger? How did you deal with it?
Well, I mean, I think my parents were great in that they were understanding that definitely there was some sort of agitation inside of me. But I always knew they would protect me in whatever way that would take shape, right? They took me to see a therapist, which in Winchester, Tennessee in the 90s was we had to drive, you know, an hour and a half to Nashville just to see somebody. And so no matter how scary these things were, because my parents, I knew, would do whatever they could to take care of me, it still wasn't as scary as what it could have been, right? And a lot of my stories, I think, are about bad parents, because to me, that's the greatest fear. I think about what would have happened if I didn't have parents who loved me and were open-minded. My life would have been completely different. So that's always my huge conflict and narrative is, what would it be like to have a parent that wouldn't take care of you?
Well, and in this book, I mean, without giving too much away, there are kind of two families that are formed.
Right.
And the family that from the outside looks weird turns out in many ways to be a lot more normal than the family that looks normal on the outside. I mean, is that something you think about and play with a lot in your writing?
Yeah, I think that anytime a group of people form a family, either on purpose or just by birth, there's no way that kind of combustible combination of these different personalities, it's going to create weirdness. There's just no way around it. And so I think to some extent, it's how much effort do you put into hiding that? Because I don't, you know, having been around enough families, I don't think there are normal families. There may be normal people within those families, but once you put them together and you watch the way they interact and you see how years and years and years of how they've gotten used to each other creates a kind of weirdness that to me is fascinating. And so I understand why people try to hide that weirdness because of how they need to navigate through the world, but that's not interesting to me, right? I want it out in the open.
And when you were growing up, did you feel weird?
Yeah, I felt super weird. I felt strange, and the world seemed scary and big to me in ways that the response was to burrow deeper inside of myself. And our family, we were really isolated in a lot of ways, and it was lovely.
Like out in the country isolated?
Well, more just the way our family operated was we were each other's world entire. My sister and my parents were my best friends. And I had really close friends, but I always understood that was separate from the family unit. And so just little things like, I mean, they're small, but like even on Friday nights, you know, when my sister and I were in high school, we would play canasta with my parents. Like we made this little world for ourselves where no matter what was going on in the outside world, there was this place for us to be safe, you know, and my parents worked really hard to create that for us. So yeah, I felt weird, but I knew that I could be weird in this space and it wouldn't matter.
And did it bother you at all that you weren't doing like what maybe the other high school kids were doing on Friday nights?
No, I don't think I would. I mean, I know what the other kids were doing in high school on Friday nights, and that would have terrified me. I wouldn't have enjoyed being out in the open world in that way. So no, I liked where I was.
Did your parents play a lot of music around the house, or was there like art and stuff? I have a particular reason I'm asking that, but answer that part first.
Yeah, yes, very much so. My parents loved music. My parents especially love comedy. And so that was one of the kind of first ways that I found like an interest in art was just through sitcoms, through comedy records, Eddie Murphy, Richard Pryor, Bob Newhart. Like, it was this kind of shorthand where I could see that my parents would respond to humor because they loved it. And that made me want to figure out how to be funny, right? So, because I wanted to make them laugh the same way those comedians did. And when we watched sitcoms, that was kind of what we delighted in, that kind of absurdity and humor. So my parents always really liked art that was funny, that was a little silly. I think that seeped into the way I look at how I make art.
Yeah. The reason I ask about music in particular is a sequence in the book where the couple of the characters are having a discussion about great Tennesseans.
Yes.
And one of your characters, or the protagonist, I guess, basically says, "It's Dolly Parton, end of story. I can't believe we're having this discussion." I know that your character is not always a reflection of you, but is that sort of your feeling too?
Yeah, I mean, my parents...
I mean, there can't be anybody else,
I don't know anyone that doesn't love Dolly Parton. I don't know anyone that doesn't think that Dolly Parton isn't the best representation of what Tennessee can be. She's incredibly artistic. She's incredibly talented. She has a beautiful voice. She's a humanitarian. She cares very much about place and region. She's perfect, to my mind, you know. And as an artist, she's perfect. I mean, if you're going to vote for the best Tennessean, I think it's Dolly Parton, and then it goes way down.
Yeah. Have you been listening to that Dolly Parton podcast?
I haven't, but everyone has told me that it's incredible.
It's very good. And one of the things they get at, which echoed with me through reading your book, is that what she keeps coming back to over and over is this idea of home, mm-hmm. what home means to you. And clearly the characters in your book are all trying to figure that out in one way or another. Some of them think they know what it is and they don't.
Right.
And others think they don't know and they kind of do.
Yeah.
And so is that tie in with the sort of family idea for you as well?
Yeah. For me, I can't write about family without also writing about the structure that holds that family, which is what I call home, right? So in my head, I always think of myself as a domestic writer. I know my novels aren't defined as domestic novels, but what I care about is placing a group of people who are connected in some way within a space, right? And what I love is how do we build a structure that will protect us, that will support us, and that will expand as our family changes. And so that house is literal, but of course then it becomes metaphorical as it expands and changes in our idea of it. So yeah, all of my stories that I write, the home is really important. Like, I spend a lot of time, and oftentimes I try to create a narrative where the characters can't leave the home. You know, I don't want them to leave.
That clearly happens in this book.
Yeah, yeah. I figure out a kind of way in the narrative to keep them locked into a single space, because to my mind, the longer you stay inside that home, the more you reveal of yourself, right? And the more that the home takes on a shape that can hold you. So that's what I come back to again and again.
And I feel like there, in this book, there are pretty vivid descriptions of what the places that each character ends up in. And you get a really good sense of what that place looks like and how it's appointed and all those sort of things. And it sounds like you think about those details a lot.
Yeah. And for me, I mean, it's this idea in the book that this family has built this basically guest house. They've retrofitted it for these two kids and Lily and the main character. And they've taken all these steps. They've made it exactly what they think will be a perfect house. And what you realize is that the minute the children and Lillian walk into it, it's redefined, right? Because once they inhabit the space, the house has to change. It's not just an idea of a house. It's where they actually live. And I don't know why that's fascinating to me, but I love that moment where you inhabit, you actually are in a home.
So have you had that feeling like when you moved into a new place and are trying to figure out how you and that place work together?
Yeah. And now that I have a family of my own, it becomes really interesting. What I've always loved when I was single was a space that was small enough to contain me and protect me. And now that I have a family, a wife and two little boys, it's strange to consider home not just how it affects me, but how does this space fit everyone in the family, right? And so there are considerations, and I don't even just mean design. I just mean like, what does the home mean to my boys, and how is that different from what I think home is? And so even my idea of the house that we've lived in for 5 years changes as we grow and as we change.
So how has it been different, or how, what have you noticed has been different in the way that you think it's home to the way your kids think it's
home? So for me, what home is an isolated, comfortable place where I know that I'm protected, right? And those spaces are very clearly defined. This is my room. This is where I do my work. This is where I eat. And having children, they don't care about those borders or those definitions. And so once we had kids, what happened to the house is those clearly demarcated lines of separation were completely erased. And so my children, they inhabit every space of the house. They believe that it is entirely theirs, and I want them to believe that. So my room is not my room anymore. It's a room that I'm in that my children are also in. And we have this huge play space. It's the biggest room in the house, and we got that part. We bought the house partly because we thought this will be a great place for them to play, but it's down. It's in a split level, so it's downstairs. And they never play in that play space. They want to be upstairs. They want to be witnessed around us. And that kind of makes me happy. Even though I wanted that play space to be something for them, I like the idea that they feel safe with us, and that becomes their play space.
So what is a play space now?
It's just a big room. It's where they keep their stuff. So they'll run down and get it and then bring it up to us. And I'm sure there'll be a time when my boys are teenagers that they'll think, we've got to get downstairs. We need those rooms and spaces so we can be separate from our parents. Because right now we're right across the hall from each other. So I know that this house will change, you know, just year by year, the way we define it will change.
When we come back, Kevin Wilson talks about how he became a writer and what it feels like to get a glowing review in the New York Times. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
I'm Mike Collins. Washington is on the verge of a consequential decision.
To have the House of Representatives formally impeach a president is a seismic event in constitutional law. It's not just a slap on the wrist. It is something that stays with that president for all time.
Count on Charlotte Talks for analysis and context of the impeachment debate. Listen weekday mornings at 9 or wherever you get your podcasts.
A couple weeks ago, I forgot to mark an anniversary here at Southbound. Our last episode was our 50th episode since we started this podcast 2 years ago. So, of course, this one is number 51. I didn't know if there would ever be any episodes at all. A guy with a weird voice, having long conversations with fellow Southerners, that wasn't much of a fastball to pitch. But WFAE took a chance on me and on Southbound, and I couldn't be more grateful. I'm just as grateful for you and for all our listeners. I've heard from people throughout the South, all over the country, and even in a few places around the globe. We're trying to make Southbound better all the time. Thanks for sticking with us, and please feel free to tell your friends and neighbors. I appreciate every voice in the chorus. Now, let's get back to my conversation with Kevin Wilson. When you were growing up, and you said you felt really weird, and you had this condition that obviously you were trying to figure out what that meant and all. Maybe as you got a little older, as a teenager or something, did you ever worry that you wouldn't have a family of your own, that like you wouldn't find somebody who would love you for what you were, basically?
Yeah. I mean, I think very early on in my time in college, I went to Vanderbilt in Nashville, which was like an hour and a half away from where I grew up in Winchester, Tennessee. And there was this moment, maybe my sophomore year, where I kind of thought, I think when I finish college, I think I'm going back home. I'm going to live with my parents. They'll take care of me. And I knew they were happy to do that. And I said, and that's where I'll live. I'll live in that space for the rest of my life. Having a family of my own, I just couldn't imagine how that would happen.
And why? What was in the way of imagining that, you think?
Just feeling that I wasn't capable of it, that I wouldn't be able to provide the kind of space that people that I loved would need, you know, that would support them. So again, the response was to burrow deeper inside of myself, to go back home. And really, truly, I think art, like once I realized I wanted to write, writing and making art opens you up to the world in a way that can be uncomfortable, but it's necessary. And once I started writing, I realized that there was this world that I wanted to touch, you know, that previously had been closed to me. And that's when I started thinking I could open my world up.
So how did that happen as far as kind of becoming a writer and that sort of thing? What led you in that place?
Well, what led me to become a writer?
Sure.
Yeah, I had had these images and these narratives in my mind. I lived and I still live so much in my head. And, you know, you grow up in Winchester, Tennessee, like you don't understand, like guidance counselors aren't telling you like, hey, you should be a writer. That's not a viable option. So it wasn't entirely clear to me that people wrote, contemporary people. And when I got to college, I started reading writers, you know, living writers, and was exposed to them.
I've heard so many people mention that they didn't realize until at some point, like college or somewhere, that all the writers weren't dead already.
Yeah. And it was more like even like I knew obviously there was like Tom Clancy and John Grisham. Like,
sure.
And I knew there were writers and I'd love Judy Blume and all that. But it's still that didn't feel tangible to me in some way. They seemed like akin to movie stars. But I didn't know that you could like just write because you loved it and you could make a life for yourself doing that until I got to college. And then I was exposed to these people. And once I saw that was a possibility, I knew that I wanted more. I wanted more of life.
Was there something, some writer in particular or some story or novel or something that you were exposed to in particular that sort of flipped the switch for you?
Well, I mean, if I go all the way back into my childhood, the first novel that really transformed me was Marjorie Kinnan Rollins' The Yearling, which it's about a boy who takes on the care of this young fawn, and it's set in Florida. And I was probably 9 maybe when I read it, and there was this moment as I was reading it where I really for the first time felt connected to the narrative. It was Southern. It was a place that I wasn't maybe used to seeing in books. But I also felt my life opening up because the story was providing me an understanding of what life could be. And it's actually a pretty harsh book for kids. I mean, there's a lot of pain in it and a lot of sadness. And
many of those kid stories, Bambi, Old Yeller, all that.
Yeah.
I mean,
and
people, things die.
I know. And I always wonder, like, why is that? But there's something for that book that it was, life is hard. And there's a moment where the father says, you know, life, you hate sending your kids out in the world and watching them get kind of crushed by it, but what can you do but take it for your share and move on? And there was something thrilling, even though it was scary, to think, I can survive this, right? That there will be pain, but it's actually pain that I can survive. And I don't think that had been apparent to me before. So that book started me where I realized, oh, that's what a book can do. It can transform you. And then, you know, I know like, and I went to Vanderbilt and we read Southern writers and I know there's like Faulkner and there's Flannery O'Connor. But the writer that I kind of found on my own because we didn't read them in the classes that I took was Carson McCullers. And she was the writer for me that I locked onto in college. I don't know how she's revered compared to those kind of other Southern writers. But to me, she's the best. She's my favorite. And part of it was what McCullers did for me was that she introduced me to this idea that the characters could be freakish, right? They could be freaks. And I think O'Connor does that too, but there's not a lot of grace to me in O'Connor's work.
Right.
With if you're freakish, it's a kind of doom. And for McCullers, what I loved about her work was that you were freakish, but that didn't mean you weren't human. It didn't erase your humanity. And that was so comforting to read when you're 21 years old, right? And it's not like her books are happy, but I never doubted that no matter how freakish her characters were, that they weren't also human and like deserving of dignity. So she transformed me. And once I figured that out, that was the writer where I thought, that's what I want to do. I know my work will have sadness in it, but I want there to be enough empathy that the people are human.
One of the things I noticed about your style, I guess is the right word, is that it doesn't feel super stylish. And I mean, that is a compliment. It just sounds like how regular people talk. And I think for many young writers, it's a very difficult thing to do to get normal conversation onto the page. Has that been something that has kind of come naturally to you, or has it taken a while to sort of get there?
I think so much of any kind of artistic form, what we oftentimes we think that our style is what our strengths are, and generally, to my mind, it's usually what our limitations are. And so for me, I don't write lyrical, beautiful sentences. That's beyond me in some ways, and that's a weakness. Like, I'm not
sure I would call it a weakness.
Well, it's for me, like, if I wanted to write like Cormac McCarthy or Zora Neale Hurston, like, I don't possess that ability. And so what I had to figure out was then how am I going to work around that lack of lyricality? And so what I came up with was, well, then I'm gonna get the plain spokenness correct. I'm gonna get rhythm correct, and I'm gonna make sure that when my characters speak, it reflects the awkwardness of how we communicate, right? And so, for me, that's my way into the narrative. Is that language is a little awkward, especially when we're trying to make ourselves known. And so, when I write dialogue, I don't want my characters to talk in any way that's poetic. I want them to sound like someone who's trying desperately to make themselves known, but it's just almost always impossible.
That was always my issue with Pat Conroy, who I know many people love.
Yeah.
Nobody in his books ever talked like a normal human being.
And that was actually appealing to me. And I read him in junior high. He was the first like real Southern writer when my mom gave me Lords of Discipline. And there was something to that lyricality of how they spoke where I was like, is this the South? You know, is this how people speak? And I've just lived this isolated life. And so for me, there was something that I kind of aspired to, but just found I couldn't do it, you know?
Right, yeah. Right. So in this book, you talk about a sort of prep school life that a couple of these characters grew up in. And it's clear that it's not a life you're fond of or that sort of thing. You teach at the University of the South.
Yes.
Which, in my mind anyway, is like a collegiate version of this prep school you're talking about.
Yes.
Sort of elite people go there who have come from generations of money, that sort of thing. First of all, is that an accurate description? And secondly, if it is, how do you keep from sort of chafing against the place?
So, and I think part of like an important thing about that question is that I grew up in that county. I've lived almost my entire life in Franklin County, and I grew up in the Valley in Winchester, Tennessee. I went to South Junior High, Franklin County High School. And then there is Suwanee, which is part of that county, but it's the mountain. And that's where the University of the South resides. And so I was always aware of it as a kid, but it was a place that felt separate from me. It was not a place that I necessarily would think to go or would feel welcome. And now that I live in that space, I have to reconsider what Suwanee is and how it fits into that world. And it's hard when your school is called the University of the South not to, in some ways, be haunted by the history of it.
Sure.
And so, to my mind, there is always going to be that element of these legacies, these generations of rich, privileged Southern people who come to the University of the South. But because it's on a mountain and because it's isolated, and because I think college has become such a kind of open-ended experience that people are trying to figure out where they want to be, what we start to draw and what I've found is we still get those other people, but what we also get is a kind of weird, curious, independent student who wants that isolation, who wants to be in this kind of environment where the natural world is completely open and accessible. And so it's just this weird mix of students, right, where you have privilege right next to these kind of strange kids who are dumbfounded that they've ended up in this place, but they love it. And it's a good place for me. And there's always going to be that weirdness of like, well, I'm from Winchester, I'm from the Valley, and now I'm here. Somehow I made it in here, and I feel slightly like an imposter. Yeah, it took me 20 years, but I made it to the top of the mountain. And there's something where I'll always feel like an imposter in that respect. But for me, it's important to be there. It's important for me to teach those kids. And then I get those moments where it's a kid from Winchester, from Franklin County High School, who comes up to the mountain. And when I see those kids in my class, there's just this immediate happiness where I was like, I'm gonna do everything for you so that you're happy here.
I want to ask a couple more sort of book business-centered questions.
Sure.
First of all, you got one of the all-time great New York Times reviews that I can ever imagine from Taffy Broadisser Agner, who's wrote a really good book this year.
Yes, yes.
Right. I think she wrote that she had to like put the novel she was working on down because she was so impressed with your work and she wanted to try to keep up with it. Basically quoted your dialogue at length and that sort of thing. What did it feel like when that showed up in the New York Times?
Well, it was unexpected. I didn't know it was happening, obviously, and our boys go to two different schools because one's in middle school and one's in elementary. And so my wife was taking the youngest to school, and I still had time with my son Griff. And my editor texted me and said, "This review just came out."
And so you didn't know there was going to be one at all.
I had heard there would be one, but I didn't know when. And so it just surprised me. So I opened it and I just read the first line. And I ran outside to get my wife. I was waving my arms and she was driving down the driveway. And she thought that my son had had a fit or something, that it was an emergency. And I just read her the first line and she was like, "That's amazing. I have to go. We got to go." And so I ran back into the house with Griff, who doesn't care. And I just kind of vibrated for a while. And to have your work seen in that way, to be thought of by someone who is such an outstanding writer is, I mean, one of the reasons that I write is because I loved reading so much that I wanted to connect with those writers who meant something to me. And so to have a fellow writer say that was incredibly meaningful. It was completely unexpected, and I still fully don't believe it. It's not a reality that I understand.
That's a good way to say it. The second thing I wanted to ask about is one of your earlier books, The Family Fang, was made into a movie.
Yes.
And it was not a blockbuster.
Yeah.
But it did have Jason Bateman, Nicole Kidman, some really good actors in it.
Yeah.
What was that experience like for you?
Oh, it was like winning the lottery. It was, it's just random dumb luck. You know, Nicole Kidman, who lives near Nashville, had heard on NPR that there was a local Tennessee author who had written this novel, The Family Fang. She read it and she loved it. And she got in touch and wanted to option it. And so I got to meet Nicole Kidman and sit down with her, and I would have given it to her for free. You know, I was just like, you can have it. But she had read the book closely. She had interesting thoughts about it. I love adaptation because I don't have any possessiveness over the material. My book is always going to be my book. So I really, if I put it in the hands of somebody that I think is brilliant and smart and cares about it, it doesn't matter to me what ends up happening. You know, that becomes their work. So it was a great experience. And again, you sell an option and you have no idea if it'll actually happen. And every step of the way, I thought it would die, but you know, like something would pick up. We found a Pulitzer Prize winning playwright's going to write the screenplay, and then it kind of died, and then Jason Bateman was going to direct it, and then it kind of died, and then they got the money, and so it's just, it feels like luck, you know. And so much of, the way I try to think of my career is that I believe that I'm a good writer. Like, I know that I have a certain level of talent, but I can't imagine how anybody that has any success in this world doesn't believe that 99% of it is just complete random dumb luck, and that it's not that you were deserving, and it's not that you put in more work. It's just completely random and lucky. And so I appreciate it. You know, it felt like a gift.
I was going to say, I always think about this too. Can you go back and see little moments in your life where you feel like you got lucky, and if it had gone a different way, you know, maybe you wouldn't be here?
Yeah. I that's all I think about. There's so much of my life that I think, oh, I should have done this differently. I wish I'd been a better person. I wish I'd been stronger. And then I think of just these random moments. And so the big one for me, career-wise, was I had been the 2 years I did not live in the South. I was in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I was working in the gender studies program at Harvard Graduate School of Education. And I had a nervous breakdown, which was not unusual for me. And my parents had to come get me. They picked me up. I quit my job. I drove to Winchester and lived with my parents. And as I was living there, Ann Patchett was reading at Vanderbilt, where I had gone to school a few years earlier. And I went to the reading, and there was a lunch beforehand. And just by random dumb luck, I sat next to Ann, and we talked. And she had been at Radcliffe, which was right across the street from where I had been working. So we talked about it. She was lovely. I had been a huge fan of her work. She was had always been one of my favorite writers. And then a couple weeks later, I'm in my PJs at my mom and dad's house, and my mom says, Ann Patchett is on the phone. She wants to talk to you. And she said, I'm going on book tour, and would you take care of my dog, Rose? And I said, sure, because I had nothing going on. I think my parents were super happy to get me out of the house and onto the road to recovery. And so I lived in Ann's house and took care of her dog, Rose. And Ann would go away, and she would give me her favorite books, and I would read them. And when she came back from the road, we would talk about them. And she'd go away again and give me more books. And my whole life opened up because Anne let me into that world. And she's always been kind of a fairy godmother. From that point on, she's looked out for me. And I know that she's made opportunities for me, but it's more that Anne showed me how to be not just a writer, but like a good human being, you know? And I think about what my life would be like if I hadn't moved back in with my parents all those years ago.
And if you'd sat one row over.
I know. It was just, again, pure dumb luck. I didn't deserve Anne's kindness more than somebody else. It's just I happened to be there and it worked out.
So one thing I think about, and obviously you've thought about, is part of the luck we draw or don't draw in our life is our parents.
Yeah.
You know, I come from a family with two stable, loving parents and didn't realize until much later that that wasn't the case for so many other people.
Yeah.
Now you're a parent.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that your son has some of the same Tourette's or something.
He had some issues with anxiety. As he gets older, they become more defined as specifically his. When I looked at him as a kid, I was like, oh, he's me, you know, right. And everything that he's experiences is because of me. And I think maybe one of the scary but also lovely things about having children is that as they become older, they become their own person. And you'll see parts of yourself in them, but then you start to realize that, oh, I was deluded to think that I could be wholly responsible for this person, that I was the reason they are the person they are, because they're so unique and strange. So Griff has anxiety, and I see it, and I can feel that similarity. Yeah, so we possess it, but it's his own.
And do you try to, I mean, in the sort of metaphorical sense, try to keep him from bursting into flame? Or, and this is the other question I had about that, I guess. You know, you talk about that anxiety over that happening with you first,
right,
and then with your kids. Are you more worried about how that will affect them? Or are you worried about how it affects the people around them?
Oh, no, it's them.
Okay.
I don't care about other people. You know what I mean? Like if Griff were to burst into flames, the whole world could burn down. It wouldn't matter to me. All that would matter is that Griff got out of it. And so what I try to do is what I knew my parents did for me in the face of, you can never know the mystery inside of another person, no matter how much you believe that you can. And so what I want Griff to know is that what he experiences, whatever it is, I'm there. My wife is there. My other son is there. And that he's not alone. But also, whatever darkness or weirdness that he thinks is inside of him that's unspeakable, it exists. Other people know it. Other people have experienced it. And he can feel less alone in that. And to me, that's most important. And frankly, that's what literature did for me, was this understanding. Like, people are always like, why are books so sad? Like, why is there so much sadness or pain in stories? And to me, it's invaluable to know that we have a shared pain. Do you know what I mean? That we're not the only person. And, you know, if every narrative is about pain in some ways, then the way that we write the story is how we survive it. So every story to me is about survival. And those are good maps to have.
We are all weird. As much as anything, that's the point of Kevin Wilson's work. Even if it's not obvious to the rest of the world, we all have strangeness inside us. And knowing that you're not the only strange one is a life-changing thing. When you know you're not alone, you can see a path to love and family and hope. Kevin Wilson sees visions, and he's had nervous breakdowns. He hasn't let that keep him from the career and the family that he always wanted. It hasn't been easy for him. It's not easy for most of us. But it's possible. And the possibilities of life, once you believe in them, are miraculous. So much so that it can make your heart burst into flames. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where we have show notes for each episode with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.